Dakota has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including the Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal, Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
Receiving this message. We are Ken Jennings and John Roderick. We speak to you from our present, which we can only assume is your distant past, the turbulent time that was the early 21st century.
Fearing the great cataclysm that will surely befall our civilization, we began this monumental reference of strange and obscure human knowledge. These recordings represent our attempt to compile and preserve wonders and esoterica that would otherwise be lost.
So whether you're listening from an advanced civilization or have just reinvented the technology to decrypt our transmissions, this is our legacy to you.
This is our time capsule. This is the Omnibus.
You have accessed entry 913.PS1833, certificate number 21218, pedestrianism.
So, Ken, have I ever told you about the time that I walked across Europe?
Hold on. Let me just go through my notes here.
Do you take notes on our conversations?
I keep notes on all my friends. It was something I learned from J. Edgar Hoover. I think he used to do it. Now, is that the only reason you wanted to do this show is because you walked across Europe?
Well, no. Actually, the reason I wanted to do it is you just got back from a long trip to Chile.
I was hiking in Chile. It wasn't that long, but it was a week of hiking, yeah.
A week is long?
It's longer than I wanted to hike. Let's put it that way.
It's long if you're a protozoa.
You mean like in terms of length?
Yeah, just, well, no, I mean.
Yeah, protozoa is like a nanometer or whatever.
Oh, I see. So you're saying that a week has like dimensional length?
I thought you meant the hike. I was like, yeah, it's true. That protozoa would have a really hard time. I mean.
Oh, on the hike.
He might have more legs than I do, but he's going to have a hard time on that trail.
No, I was saying like the length of a week in terms of a protozoa.
I would have said like a mayfly.
Okay.
Mayfly, goldfish, I don't know. What else dies quick?
Honestly, I don't even know how long a protozoa lives. Do you?
What if they live like a million years and people are already emailing you? John, protozoa live a variety of spans.
There are biologists who like jumped out of their chair.
What the? I hate when that happens.
I've got them now.
I hate when people disparage the mighty protozoa in that way.
Strongly worded email. So tell us about your trip. You go on this. Is this a yearly adventure you go on with a group of bros where you go to somewhere exotic and do a long walk?
Did I never tell you about the time I walked across South America?
You have, but I don't keep notes is the problem.
Yeah. It all started when a friend wanted to go to Antarctica, and neither of our wives wanted to go to Antarctica for the sensible reason that it is not a tourist destination. Insufficiently into penguin poop, I guess.
Isn't this how all male misadventures start?
I thought you were going to say how all marriages end.
My friend wanted to buy a 67 Cadillac DeVille, I said, and my wife said no.
I'll go in on that with you. Yeah. I won't even ask her. So we started doing occasional trips that nobody's spouse felt like doing. Mm-hmm. And Mindy loves to trek and hike, but she does not like to camp. So
yeah, right. I can see that.
Again, very sensibly. There's really no level on which a tent is better than a hotel room. I mean,
in terms of if you want to hear a bear breathing in the night, at least in Alaska.
Or everyone in the tents around you making every noise they make at night.
In Minnesota, when you camp at night in the summer, sometimes the outside of the tent will be so covered with mosquitoes that like it you see like an undulation.
Wow.
Of like living, breathing protozoa in the form of mosquitoes.
Once again, John, protozoa and mosquitoes are very different.
Yeah, there were so many mosquitoes that they were actually weighing down the...
I wonder if you could, like, you know how when you make a paper mache thing and then you pop the balloon so that only the pinata remains? I wonder if you could do that with a mosquito-covered tent. Just collapse the tent really quick, and the mosquitoes just stay in a nice dome.
Wow, wouldn't that be amazing for 1 second?
We should ask, like, Tim Waltz or somebody who would be up on this. You're examining your sweater very... anxiously.
Well, I'm so irritated. I put this sweater on this morning, and it's kind of it's not cashmere, but it's like alpaca. And I thought, oh, I love this little vest. And then I looked down because I don't know why I put my finger through a hole, and I looked down, and there's a giant hole in it. And I discovered a hole in a
cardigan like last week, and I think it might be moths.
Yeah.
That's a real thing. Moths exist. And
yeah, they do.
I thought it was just in cartoons. No one told me that moths actually eat sweaters.
No, it's real. And I, for whatever reason, now I have one of the things that the Instagram algorithm knows about me is that I will watch a video of someone meticulously re-knitting a moth hole in a sweater. Because there are people in the world who can... could make this hole go away.
Well, that's a good skill because it's a beautiful sweater except for like one square millimeter of it.
It's amazing, but I cannot imagine that it is just watching these videos that it's like an inexpensive thing to have done.
You got
to
match the yarn.
You have to meet the person and say, hey, here's a hole in this sweater.
Oh, you don't want to learn how to do it. You want to find that Vietnamese child and have them do it.
Well, no, they seem to all be Italian ladies in their 60s.
Oh, perfect.
But yeah, this often comes up. I love knitwear, as you know. Mm. And whenever I'm talking to someone about knitwear and I say, yeah.
Their eyes go blank.
Well, they do. Unless they're women of a certain age, in which case they're excited by my love of knitwear.
Yeah.
But I always make the mistake of saying, yeah, I'm really trying to get my daughter to learn to knit. And then it's a real opening to say, why don't you learn to knit?
Oh, you did it.
And then
let them feel good about themselves.
Because it's women's work.
I hope you don't say that.
I don't say that. I say, oh yeah, dang it. I thought of that. But I don't know if I have the manual dexterity or patience.
Even though knitting has kind of become like Brooklyn hipster coded,
yeah.
I don't know. It seems like that has not changed the gender balance of how I imagine knitters.
Our imagination.
I don't see a cool tattooed guy knitting on the bus as much as you'd think.
There are going to be letters coming from all the tattooed guys listening to our show that love
while
to
they
knit.
While they're knitting during the show. Put your project down, put your blanket or your scarf down, and let us know.
See, this is the problem with me learning to knit is that, as you know, having been here in the bunker, what I would have is a bastick full of half-completed knitting projects that I never, ever returned to. I'd have 14 sleeves, and that would just be another thing that, like, cried to me in the night.
Mindy crochets. Mindy doesn't knit, but she crochets, and she made our kid a little Marie Curie doll at some point for Christmas. Unclear why.
It wasn't a Ruth Bader Ginsburg doll?
It was Marie Kondo instead. But, you know, it's the size of a cell phone. So how much right. Marie Curie detail can you really get? And I guess some friend of ours saw it and she was like, I'm a feminist icon. I'm an tech executive. You should make one of me. So Mindy is currently trying to crochet our friend.
Wait a minute. Really?
And trying to, you don't think you would say, I'm a feminist icon?
Are you allowed to say about yourself that you're a feminist icon?
I don't know if she said that, but the implication was, if Marie Curie, why not?
Why not a
C-level person like me? And so Mindy's frantically trying to figure out how to convey her friend's finance job at crochet stature proportions.
This is slightly off the topic of even this conversation, but I had a friend in the 90s who did make dolls of people she knew. And she
and
was
then cursed them.
She was like a goth. Like when I say like a goth, I mean deeply a goth.
Like center of the Venn diagram.
Super duper goth, like dressed like she was going to a Victorian funeral every day. And this was one of those talents about her that you didn't know until you got to know her closely. And you'd be like, hey, what are those? Oh, those are just dolls.
Oh, she wouldn't present you with a knitted thing and you'd find out about her secret life?
No, it was later, and they weren't even knitted. They were made out of, I don't know what they were made out of, human skin? Beats me.
Human skin and hair. Probably your own fragments that she had collected laboriously over the years.
I said to her, this is really uncomfortably close to like voodoo. And she said, well, I do use something that I got from the person, like some hair or something. And I was like, oh, boy. I made a weird roommate choice here.
I can't tell if it's like voodoo or if it's like Jurassic Park. I got a little bit of DNA from a follicle and I've brought you back to life in doll form.
Yeah, animated this.
Well, this whole thing happened because you looked at your sweater. So this isn't even tangentially related to,
oh, that's right,
to me hiking in South America, much less pedestrianism, whatever that is.
Well, okay, so let me ask you, as somebody who just recently walked more than 50 miles?
Oh, yeah.
More than 100 miles?
It was, no. Ben, it was the narrowest part of South America, but I did not walk across it. Although, right, in hindsight, maybe I should have. Maybe I just should have kept going until I got to Argentina and said, hey, I just walked across South America, bitches.
I think the problem is that the closer you get to Argentina, the steeper it gets. Is that right?
Well, I think, yeah, to cross Patagonia, there are going to be mountains at some point.
But it's literally in the brand.
We were just in some Chilean national park that has this outstanding, just this rugged, craggy scenery that does not look like Tetons or Yosemite or the Alps or anything else, and it was really just stunning.
So the point of the walk was naturism.
Yeah, but, well, yeah, we're not nudists. Uh-huh. First of all, we strip down because it's their summer there,
right?
we all get naked, right, and then we hit the trail. So I've done the Inca Trail with these guys. I've done the Camino in Spain, and
only Spanish language trails.
That's correct.
Have you ever considered branching out?
I don't know how to say trail in any other language. Oh. So I've been sticking to Spain. Like, if you could tell me how to say trail in French, it would open up a whole new world.
I don't know, route?
Le trail? So it was just to see the beautiful blue milky glacial lakes.
Yeah.
And the pinnacles. It looks like a Star Wars planet down there. I recommend it.
Well, you know, this idea of nature being something to contemplate, mm-hmm, and appreciate aesthetically, of course, is a thought technology. It wasn't always...
The Romantics had to invent it.
That's exactly...
Go to the mountains.
I mean, in a way, yeah, at least as far as we think of it. Prior to that, walking places was a thing that indicated that you were...
Low class, right?
Yeah, right, that you were poor or worse, vagrant. And
it was only once people didn't have to walk 20 miles to town that people started to think, what if I walk 20 miles today?
Yeah, part of that late 18th century romanticism, which was, as we all know, as every biologist who's listening to the show, every knitting hipster guy knows, romanticism was a late 18th century kind of aesthetic movement where people primarily in England, aristocrats primarily in England, wanted to return to a kind of natural...
An imagined past.
Right. An imagined past where the bucolic arts got us more, you know, and this was a reaction to the Industrial Revolution and increasing industry.
I mean,
the idea that, yeah.
It still works on me. If I'm in LA for 3 days, I'm like, I'd like to be somewhere else.
Get me out of here.
That had trees and stuff.
And so it was from, you know, from the kind of mid to late 1700s, you saw these ideas sort of come up in Wordsworth and Keats and
they're always wandering, Coleridge. Lonely as a cloud.
That's exactly what they're doing.
Stop wandering, lonely as a cloud. Go home and pay your bills.
And they had walking trails that were set up. This is kind of like the follies of great English estates, trails where vistas were kind of identified as places to stop. And you know, they were called viewing stations where you would walk out and there'd be a, you know, like this.
That makes it seem like a job. Nice. Let me go to my viewing station and look at the Lake District. Well, yep, it's still there.
It is a job being an aristocrat, Ken. I don't know if we can fully appreciate it. But also, there was, you know, the class element meant that there were also kind of this tradition of like, if you were in your carriage and you were going somewhere with another aristocrat who was in a, in his carriage, like the footmen who attended you, the aristocrats would like pit them against one another, like let's see like, whose footman
like
can
dog fighting.
Yeah, well, no, not like fighting, but like let's see whose footman can walk faster or further.
Oh, I
alongside
see. It was a
the
side
carriage.
Of your prestige that you had. Fit footman.
Yeah, that's right. A faster footman.
Look at the feet on my footman. They're fit.
That faster footman
your,
would be a
your
great...
Your footmen are fat, but my footmen are fit feet.
It sounds like a Scottish indie rock band. So, but walking across country and walking for not just physical health, but for emotional, mental edification, higher...
Right, a spiritual air. Plane, and that once you get out into the mountains,
that became kind of enshrined in the UK culturally, and then ultimately in law.
To this day, a great walking culture because there's all these right of ways you can just tramp across people's pastures.
In Scotland, in fact, there's a right to roam that basically the principle is if you haven't. If it's not actually like specifically a place that you can't roam, you can roam anywhere.
The default is roam.
Roam.
Roam right. If you want to. Roam around the glen.
And in the United Kingdom, there are walking paths, Britain and Wales, or I'm sorry, England and Wales. I just heard all of the fingers come back off of
Britain
the,
and Wales. John, and let me tell you. Your confusion about the protozoan pales in comparison to this new geographic.
But those laws now increasingly have been like that. These are very modern issues in the United Kingdom. In 2000, the Countryside and Rights of Way Act really codified this principle, and it had already been. A principle
yeah,
in
it's
law,
like common law for centuries, but
the law basically was once a highway, always a highway. That traditionally, but now I think between now and 2031, there's maybe not a mad rush, but everything that's going to be a public right of way is being put on maps. They're going through because this is all being spearheaded by. A group called the Ramblers Association, and the Ramblers Association is, you know, they're a quaint, but also
they're dotty. I bet
legally
they're in tweeds. A
legally aggressive group of tweedy walkers who are you know mapping all of England.
I remember looking this up when we were like hiking in Yorkshire. Last year. Mm-hmm. And I was surprised by how recent it was that there was this tradition of right of way, but it was this ongoing battle between landowners and ramblers, like you say, that, you know, didn't really start to get codified that much until like, you know, Tony Blair era when people started to say, let's get this as national law.
Well, famously, Madonna and Guy Ritchie bought a kind of 1,300 acre estate.
I remember.
Big grade two mansion. And then there were people walking across walking across her lawn. And they sued to protect their property from ramblers. And the ramblers were like.
The ramblers rose up.
They did. They
Madonna,
said,
we used to love you. You're a gay icon. However.
And there was a pitched battle. And at one point, Madonna actually made the case that it was a human rights violation to have people walk across her lawn.
That's what you love. You love when celebrities get to say stuff like that.
But, you know, you can imagine, like, it's one thing to be some rich burger and having, you know, country squires walk across the back of your... But if you're Madonna...
It's a paparazzi problem.
Yeah, and there are people with giant lenses. Yeah. And so it went to court, and they ended up saying, okay, this part of your property is protected, but this lower part where they can't see the house is open to ramblers. It was funny when I was researching it, there were obviously lots of newspaper articles, And some of them, the headline was, Madonna wins legal battle against Ramblers. They're confined to tiny corner of lot. And then the next article was like, Madonna loses in Ramblers pitch battle. Win. Ramblers get all these acres down in
It's the- hard to say which side of the ideological spectrum of British papers would have the pro-Madonna headline or the pro-Rambler headline. Who knows?
I know. It's one it's that inscrutable. Really split the game.
Did she have to put up like cone bras, like traffic cones across the lawn so that...
When I walked across England, I don't know if I've told you about this time in my life, but I didn't know about the walking paths and discovered them kind of, I mean, not kind
accidentally.
Of, completely accidentally.
This is awesome.
Where I'm looking at a map and I'm walking along a country lane and then there's a path and there's actually a little sign that's like, walking path.
It had an accent.
Hello. Hello. Hello, matey.
A little sign. This
little walking path.
The sign is in Spinal Tap.
And I said, wow, look at that. And I walked the path. And I think in the end, that path took me somewhere that probably I should have just stayed on the road. But then I increasingly started to use this network. And you're out in the middle of, you're walking along a hedgerow.
It's so charming. You go over the hedgerows in these little stiles or there'll be gaps in the beautiful old stone fences with, you know, close the gate or the cows get out, yeah. You know, warnings. And
they were wonderful. And the number of times that I almost got trampled by a horse or that a guy on a tractor, at one point I was walking across a field and a guy on a tractor shook his fist at me, like literally like.
Was it Guy Ritchie? He probably sounds like that.
No, they're in the other part. And I realized, oh, I was rambling on something that was not within, you know, as he saw it, this was not rambleable.
This was ramble proof.
Because he was plowing it, I guess. And I was like, hey, I thought you'd ramble everywhere. If it once a highway. And he was like, it was never a highway.
It were never.
But I crossed a little stream one time on a stone that was clearly like a Neolithic stone. It had been worked and toppled and put over this creek at some point, and it just felt like...
Some ancient peoples had...
It was at least Roman, and I stood... Because I'm out in the middle of, you know, BFE, and I'm like, how did this stone get here, and how long has it been here over this little creek? Pretty romantic.
We love the Druids
for
helping us out.
No one knows who they were or what they were doing, but inevitably, by the late 18th century... people in England had begun to challenge each other to walking contests.
Walking's now a skill.
The thing that is the most basic thing.
If you're like a one-year-old, walking's a pretty good skill.
Pretty good skill. Not everybody can do it, but a lot of people can.
You're always jealous of your peers who can walk before you do.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
Pass their walking test.
I mean, I don't know how much jealousy there is in one-year-olds, but yes, that's right. By the time you're five, you're like, I'm good at walking. I'm good at walking, say the little
Brits. Is everyone in this story going to be British?
No, because it does come to America.
Good, finally.
But there was, I guess, in 1773, a man by the name of Foster Powell walked from London to York and back.
Foster the Powell.
A great indie rock band.
I love Foster the Powell. Why do I have the bell, by the way?
Oh, well, we both have bells now.
Oh, it's a two-bell system?
Yeah, I got here. Hit your bell and let's see if they're the same.
Just like in real life, you're the baritone.
A little deeper bell.
Look at that.
So you've got a bell over there and you can hit it whenever...
Whenever you say something funny. Yeah. That's why no one will ever hear it.
The bells haven't been rung in a long time. Ken, you and I have both been fairly candid about how, as we've gotten older, it seems like our hair is getting a little thinner, a little, hopefully, I feel like I'm right on the border of it being not a little thinner, but thin, which is not what I intended as a rock star to have thin hair. And what I'm realizing is that there are technologies now, there are solutions to thinning hair that didn't exist in my father's day. In fact, if you've lost your hair, it doesn't mean you can't find it again. I'm talking about Hims hair loss solutions. where hundreds of thousands of subscribers have found their hair again. It can be hard for men to deal with hair loss, even though it's common. But luckily, there's a solution, so you don't even have to talk about it. Although, I feel like talking about it is part of finding your hair again, right? We need to, men really need to talk to one another about the things that are bothering them. Using Hims, you can restore your hair by accessing personalized hair loss solutions. The thing about Hims is it provides convenient and quality access to a range of hair loss treatments that work all from the comfort of your couch. Hims makes treating hair loss simple with doctor-trusted options and clinically proven ingredients like finasteride and minoxidil that can regrow hair in as little as 3 to 6 months. And you can choose between chewables, oral applications, spray, serum treatments to find out what's best for you. Some of those, like it's very easy for me to do a chewable. I don't want to put schmutz in my hair. But Ken, I know you like schmutz in your hair. So, you know, different strokes, am I right? The process is simple and 100% online, so there are no uncomfortable or more boring or hard to schedule doctor's visits. You just answer a few questions with a medical provider and determine if treatment is right for you. No insurance is needed, and one low price covers everything. So if you feel like your hair is getting thinner or thin or is full on out the door, start your free online visit today at hims.com/omnibus. That's H-I-M-S, hims.com/omnibus for your personalized hair treatment options. hims.com/omnibus. Results vary based on studies of topical and oral minoxidil and finasteride. Prescription products require an online consultation with a healthcare provider who will determine if a prescription is appropriate. Restrictions apply. See website for full details and important safety information. And because of the nature of the popular press at the time, starved for any kind of story that wasn't about young children being thrown into furnaces or whatever it is that occupied the English in 1773, his 400-mile walk from London to York was a news item.
Nobody had ever considered such a thing.
Not as a sport, right?
Yes.
There were, I'm sure
everyone
there were,
had to do it at one point.
There were peddlers that did it all the time, but he did it, and it was like an event that made him, that gave him some notoriety, and then he felt sort of now challenged to beat his London to York feat.
Beat his own time?
He's basically now in a position where people are like, hey, Walker, what's
next for you?
How you been walking? And what he thought to do was walk 100 miles. And now he'd already walked 400 miles from London to York.
So he's walked 500 miles? And then could he walk 500 more?
He's about to walk 500 miles in the telling of my story. But he's going to walk 100 miles in as fast as he can.
Oh.
And he makes it in 21 hours and 35 minutes.
100 miles in 21 hours. That's a good pace.
It is a good pace.
He's keeping up 5 miles an hour. That's a very brisk. I mean, that's even for a jog or a trot. Do you feel like he's walking? What's he doing? Did he just invent jogging?
It's not jogging. But it, I mean, there right now, our friend, our good friend Ben Gibbard, your close personal friend Ben Gibbard.
He's like your close personal friend, and I can kind of picture everything about him but his face.
Yeah, this is the problem, right? There have been multiple times that you've run into him in airports and stuff, and every time you're like, oh, hello, nice fan, and he's like, it's me, Ben. We've met 6 times. Like, he is mad about it.
Yeah, he always likes to walk the grounds from the Cascade to Puget Sound.
He's a marathoner. He decided he was going to do ultra marathons, And for the last several years, he's been doing them. And 100 mile, and these are mountain. They're not marathons like around a track.
He's not going around Green Lake 102 times.
No, they're mountain trails. You go up and run a kind of slope that I would consider a steep hike.
This was the time I didn't recognize him. He was just tearing down Tiger Mountain all pink and sweaty.
Yeah.
And I had never seen him pink and sweaty.
He's gnarly at it. And I think those 100-mile marathons that they run up and around and through the mountains take between 20 and 30 hours. They're not very different. In fact, they take longer for these runners. And I've said to him, like, do you run? And he's like, it's not all running. I mean, up these steep hills, you're just climbing.
But that's a long time.
It's a long time.
When do you sleep and eat and watch TV?
You don't. You go. You go and go and go. And this was what was so impressive about Foster Powell's accomplishment, doing 100 miles in 21 hours and 35 minutes, was like, this was a hell of a pace, especially for a time.
Less rugged terrain than a Ben Gibbard would accept, yeah. But
walking on country lanes, presumably. Yeah. But it's still an endurance exercise. I mean, walking for 21 hours, doing anything for 21 hours.
This guy seems like he would be in plausibly good shape for today, you know, not just for his time.
And because of the culture at the time, there was instantly a betting culture, a gambling culture around.
That's always the second thing that happens.
Right. It's just like, oh, I bet you he can't do it in under 22 hours.
I'm addicted. Can I bet on this?
And so someone made money, someone lost money. And then this became a new thing you could pretty easily set up and bet on. Like, I bet you my guy can go 10 miles. And it's not a running race, though. It's like an endurance, and it's really a ramble, but it's becoming sportified.
And it seems like it's before the culture of these other challenges like this. You know, the 19th and 20th centuries are full of who can fly across the Atlantic, who can swim across the English Channel, how fast can Nellie Bly get back to London? You know, but this is maybe so early that this is like the first time this has occurred to anyone, that this is a fun thing that the public can get into. We talked about the clipper ship races, I remember.
Right.
But this would predate those.
Yeah, this is, and as we'll see, it influences sport in the late 19th century.
Is there any sport by the time this is happening?
I mean, even rugby and soccer and...
Rugby hasn't become rugby yet,
tennis,
probably.
I mean, these are
things... probably boxing.
There's boxing.
Is boxing the only sport at this point?
I mean, there might be...
Bear baiting?
But a lot of them, like archery and stuff, those aren't sports. Those are hunting... I mean, you would have always had two guys sitting and competing against who could hit a tree with an arrow.
I guess that's true.
I mean, sport has always been sport. The original Olympic Games had all of this track and field stuff everybody already knew. But two aristocrats throwing javelins on their lawn is kind of different from this type of thing, which is a spectator sport. Because you can stand by the side of the road and watch the guy go by.
Right.
And go like, right on, keep on, mate. And he goes, thanks, mate. Because that's what they say to each other.
You don't get to see that much of the race.
Cheerio.
It's like Formula One.
Yeah. Exactly.
Okay, they're gone now. That was great. Let's go back to work.
And we'll see that the spectatorness of it increases over the course of the 19th century. The next real famous long-distance rambler was a man named Captain Robert Barclay Allardyce.
Wow.
Yeah. And he's part of a... He's like a guy who kind of... The captain is maybe a little bit like the Kentucky colonel.
He's not that much of a captain?
Well, you know, he's more of a captain than me.
He was probably... you know, rich enough that at some point he could buy some commission, and he was briefly in his Majesty's Army, or her.
Her Majesty's Army at the time. This is 1809, so it would have been his. He walked 1,000 miles in 1,000 hours.
Just to be the man?
No.
To walk 1,000 miles to wind up at your door?
As a bet where he would win 1,000 guineas.
Okay. That's a lot of money back then.
That's a lot of money.
That's a real bet.
I mean, a guinea
is a pound and a shilling.
A pound and a shilling.
Okay.
And so it's a real bet, and it's a challenge too.
Yeah.
Like, and he was a boxing promoter or trainer, I guess. So
this is real money to him. This is not just some gentleman's wager.
Well, I think it's a gentleman's wager, but it's also real money. Right, I'm a gentleman. You're a gentleman, but if somebody offered,
I want 10,000 guineas.
Yeah, if somebody, well, it's 1,000 guineas.
I'm sorry.
But
I want 1,000 guineas
for in inflation sense. Yeah, 10,000 guineas. Let's call it. Sure. Wouldn't you walk 1,000 hours in 1,000? No, 1,000 miles in 1,000 hours.
Maybe I wouldn't. 1,000 miles, huh?
Yeah. So and
do you just go around in circles.
Well,
or do you have to leave Britain?
No, you go around in circles. Because, or you go around a route.
It's like my dad trying to get his steps in by just walking around the living room.
Yes.
Except he has to do it for 1,000 hours.
Up and down the stairs. And that's the thing. If you, I mean, you can walk a mile in considerably less than an hour. And so you walk a mile, lay down, take a nap, get up, walk a mile, lay down, take a nap. I mean, it's not that you walk 1,000 continuous miles in 1,000 continuous.
Like if
hours.
I'm on flat ground and I'm kind of going a reasonable speed, I'm going 3 miles an hour. I can walk a mile in 20 minutes. And so,
You know, in these competitions, you do get people who say, I'm going to walk 1,000 miles in 1,000 minutes, and they walk 4 miles and then they sleep for 4 hours.
Yeah.
But there is a real sleep deprivation component to it. There's just exhaustion. I mean, 1,000 hours is 41 days. So for over a month,
you're walking
42 days. You're
25 yeah. miles a day, right?
Well,
1,000 miles in 1,000 hours.
Well, yeah, right. 25 miles a day.
Those are long days.
Long days.
Those would add up.
And I mean, when I was walking, I walked 25 miles a day easily. Not easily. It's never easy, but it would be
but
a typical day.
You did.
35 kilometers, sometimes 40 kilometers in a typical day.
And was there cumulative wear on your feet and your...
Oh, God. Listen to me. I'm still talking about it 20 years later.
But as a triumph, not as a, boy, my knees hurt.
No, that's right. But the wear on the mind is...
Is evident, right, when I talk to you.
think about how smart I would have been if I hadn't done it. No, it's hard and but, you know, of course, unlike these wieners, I didn't have any support. I was sleeping outside, covered with mosquitoes, which adds a layer of complication.
Nobody
to it.
Was going to pay you 1,000 guineas.
I didn't get 1,000
when
guineas
when you got
either.
To Bulgaria or
no,
whatever.
I got 0 guineas. But it is doable, but 41 days of it without a day off to walk around Prague and say, oh... This is nice here.
It's also funny to think at the time, no one was sure if this was possible. You know,
right.
Like today we're like, yeah. You know, ultra marathon. I know people who could do that. I know people who couldn't. Back then it's like, can the human body go 1,000 miles in 1,000 hours or will a man go mad?
And a lot of the wagers on it were that he couldn't do it. I mean, it's not a wager of, well, they all were, right? Because there wasn't a time component.
There wasn't a line.
It was just... is this humanly possible? And in the end, because this was a very publicized event because it was like a feat of strength, in the end, it was estimated that over 5 million pounds changed hands in the betting about whether or not our hero, Captain Allardyce could make the trip.
Somebody got rich and it wasn't him, even if he got his 1,000 guineas.
Well, and spectators lined by the end, spectators lined the course. There were over 10,000 people saw it.
Do we know, was it close? Was it like, was he down to the last week or
No,
something?
It doesn't seem like it. It seems like he made it. And this then inspired a bunch of people to try and match his feat. And it became now a kind of... If not match that feat exactly, because not everybody has 42 days to dedicate to this, but now there was walking as a sport that was kind of easier to do than race a horse.
It's like proto Guinness World Record people.
Right.
Like, I'm going to invent a feat and be the only person who can say they've done it.
Yeah, and it wasn't just distance and time. It was also, you know, I can do this
while juggling.
I can do this until the tide comes back in, or, you know, things of this sort. In 1852, a man named Thomas Hicks beat Robert's record by going 1,500 miles in 1,000 hours.
Oh, I thought you were going to say in 1,500 hours, but no, same time frame.
No, same time frame. He was like, let's get this.
Take that, Allardyce.
Let's make this.
He's now the captain of getting his butt kicked by Robert Hicks.
Exactly. And so about this time, it started to filter over to the United States, which was always looking for a new sport, always looking for a way to bet money on something dumb.
And we've got big distances and burly men.
But kind of the first recorded or the first big star of American rambling actually built his early reputation not emulating the English ramblers, but as you would kind of expect, because America is not full of aristocrats who have romantic notions, but is full of hardworking young men who are expanding the West, a young guy by the name of Edward Payson Weston was working as a copywriter in Manhattan, and his boss kind of instructed him to go down and get a bunch of flowers off of a flower wagon that was making its rounds, collect these flowers because his boss was going to give the flowers to someone else.
He's running an errand. He's a gopher.
And Edward Weston missed the flower wagon.
Oh.
And so rather than confess to his boss that he had failed to secure the flowers, he chased the wagon, but not running. He just followed the wagon.
He wasn't that into it. He was eager to miss out on more work at the office, apparently.
And
he sauntered after the wagon.
He followed the wagon up to, you know, to 70th in Manhattan, and he got the flowers and he brought them back. And his friends, he was a copywriter at a newspaper. Mm-hmm. So his coworkers made a big to-do about it, and published this kind of mocking story about this marathon walker. And again, Weston then felt challenged to duplicate his feat.
Wait, so he gets into this by doing a stupid easy thing and being roasted?
Yeah, exactly.
That's awesome.
Exactly.
I wish that happened to me every time I did something dumb.
He was roasted, and then the following year, during the election, the presidential election, he and a coworker made a wager on who would win the election, and the loser would have to walk from New York to the inauguration in Washington.
Do you know what year this is?
1860.
There you go. It's a big election.
That's right. And Edward mistakenly bet on John Breckinridge, and when Abraham Lincoln won, he walked to Washington to see the inauguration.
Breckinridge stands in shambles. He had to walk all the way from New York.
From New York.
There's no Acela at the time.
And then again, this was covered as a sort of the lighter side of the news, humorous. Presumably there were people walking to Washington from all over in 1860.
I like this notion that reporters were basically just making their own light news because it was easier than finding and reporting it.
This guy in the office is doing something silly.
You won't believe this. He couldn't get the flowers.
What a nut. So then, now he's got a kind of national reputation as a long-distance walker, and he ends up walking from Portland, Maine, to Chicago in a month. He's like Mr. American long walker guy.
He lucked into a whole new career, and he's famous.
But by the end of the Civil War, there was a sense now that that this long-distance walking, which now was becoming exceptionally popular as a sport, needed to be differentiated from running.
People were running. Like from fires, one would suppose.
I mean, it's
molasses floods.
It would have been, because of the difference in in nutrition and physical strength, it would have been hard to run 100 miles, mm-hmm. but
Ben Gibbard would have been the most fit man on the planet.
That's right.
He would have beat Breckinridge and Lincoln standing still.
Just as St. Vincent would have been the best guitarist in the world in 1967.
Right.
Or 1965, let's say.
Yeah, get Hendrix out of there. That's right.
So there was a movement, or kind of unofficially at first, maybe an institution of rules of what constituted fair walking. And fair walking, roughly or loosely, was restricted to, at some point in your stride, one of your legs had to go all the way straight. You had to extend one leg straight.
Because when you walk, you do that, but when you run, you don't? Is that the idea?
I guess so. And then
I'm picturing a don't walk sign. Yeah.
There was the fair heel and toe rule.
Okay, I know this.
Yeah.
You can't step with the back foot until the other foot's down, right?
Yeah, your heel can't land before your toe of the other leg leaves.
Because when you jog, your feet are briefly both in the air.
That's right.
At the same time.
You're in the air. And this was sort of the new, like, no, you can't.
That's so funny to me. Like,
goof around.
You can't cheat by actually going fast.
Right.
In this sport of going fast, do not cheat by going fast.
No. You have to go fast.
That would ruin it. You have to go fast in a weird way.
Yeah, I guess it's somewhat.
Go fast in a slow way.
Somewhat like hang gliding has a rule that you can't use an engine. But that's not maybe exactly applicable, but yeah.
Just the
idea. There are rules.
I just wonder where the idea comes from that there's something that ruins the sport if people were to mix between walking and running. You know, because that's how you go. That's how you make up time. You trot a little till you're tired, and then you walk, and then you trot a little more. Like, that would be, if you're a slightly out of shape guy like me, that's how you would cover the most ground. But these guys decided, no, there's something ungentlemanly about that.
Yeah, I mean, Bob Costas famously said about speed walking that it was like seeing who could whisper the loudest. And, that's maybe what we're talking about.
That's pretty good.
Back in England, the popularity of it had kind of similarly now exploded it to the point that walkers, it was called pedestrianism, famous pedestrians were among the most famous sports figures and celebrities.
Oh, wow. They were big names. People would root for their favorite pedestrian. Or is it pedestrian or pedestrianist?
I think pedestrian is. They had, there's some indication that the first ever sports trading cards were of famous pedestrians.
Do you think pedestrian already meant somebody walking because they're not on the bus?
Pedestrian.
I wonder, well, let's see, 1716. Yes. Okay. So it already did mean, oh, but no, it originally meant, it looks like the meaning of pedestrian is like kind of second rate, unimaginative. It looks like that appears to be older.
Oh, is that right? Pedestrian was originally meant dull.
This is what the dictionary is telling me, which That's is funny, funny because you'd think it would be
the other way around.
Yeah.
COTA has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including the Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal, Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
When you think about businesses that are selling through the roof, Allbirds or Skims, sure, you think about a great product, a cool brand, and brilliant marketing. But an often overlooked secret is actually the businesses behind the business, making selling, and for the shoppers buying, simple. For millions of businesses, that business is Shopify. Nobody does selling better than Shopify, home of the number one checkout on the planet. And the not-so-secret secret, with Shop Pay, that boosts conversions up to 50%, meaning way less carts going abandoned and way more sales going So if you're into growing your business, your commerce platform better be ready to sell wherever your customers are scrolling or strolling on the web, in your store, in their feed, and everywhere in between. Businesses that sell more sell on Shopify. Upgrade your business and get the same checkout Skims uses. Sign up for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/audioboom, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/audioboom to upgrade your selling today. shopify.com/audioboom.
Yeah, it goes back to 1716 meaning dull, and it does not mean somebody walking, which you'd think is where the Latin actually comes from, ped right. for foot. It doesn't mean that until 1793. So it appears to post-date this idea of people doing these long walks recreationally or athletically.
Yeah, they had to come up with a term for it.
So
That's pretty funny.
They used the word that already meant dull. that's not great. But it does mean that it meant that before it meant somebody who has to cross in front of carriages or cars, or somebody who gets off a bus, for example. Like it meant the athlete walker before it meant the city, you know, travel walker.
Right. That's interesting. I always thought of myself as during the 90s when I did not have a car but was kind of roaming the city, I was what I considered to be kind of a pedestrian activist, which meant that I asserted the pedestrian primogeniture.
Well, nobody knows of that Washington has that unmarked crosswalk law. Right. You can cross at any corner.
That's right. Every
street drivers can murder you if they don't know that
they
law.
They can, but they don't. As you know, everyone here in Washington is performatively polite, so they'll stop, you know, to let a cat walk across it. And you're just like, God, just stop it. Well, by around this same time in England, now it was a thing that that people said, well, only a man could walk these great distances. A woman's frail frame couldn't
she would
possibly
she
do
would
it.
Turn to dust on the second kilometer.
And so women immediately took up the challenge. A young woman by the name of Emma Sharp in 1864 walked 1,000 miles in 1,000 hours and became a celebrity, as you can imagine. Big deal. And then in 1878, a woman named Ada Anderson became a huge sports star and cultural star by kind of training. Emma was someone, she was just a local girl who said, I can do that.
Yeah.
But Ada was like, I'm going to be a competitive professional pedestrian. And trained, walked 1,500 miles in 1,000 hours.
Wow. Is that like, would that have beaten any man's record at the time?
That had been done already in 1852 by Thomas Hicks, but it was, you know, it was an incredible feat. And she did it.
For her OnlyFans.
She did it. She did it for her OnlyFans.
No.
But she did it. Now as a spectacle, and she actually traveled to the United States and tried to book Madison Square Garden, which was not the current one, obviously, but the Madison Square Garden of its time.
Same spot, probably.
It was in Madison Square.
But not 1,500 miles.
No, it was not. But they had construct, or they were meant to construct a track within Madison Square Garden where she could do this in front of a large number of spectators. But the people who were running Madison Square Garden felt that this was impossible for a woman to accomplish and would result in her death, or it would be a spectator sport it would be blood sport. And they refused her the venue.
But also, wouldn't she need the venue for 1,000 hours? Or is this just for the finale or something?
This would be for 1,000 hours. But, you know, there weren't basketball games then.
Yes.
And so she went to Brooklyn to a much smaller venue called the Mozart Garden. And they set up a track inside. But it was since it was a much smaller venue, the track was only 187 feet long. in circumference, which meant that
how many laps is that?
That It was, let's see, 7 laps equaled a quarter mile.
About 28, 30 to the mile.
So it's basically walking around my house.
She has to go 1,500 miles?
So she's going to do, in 2,700 quarter hours, she's going to do...
quarter? That's not the right unit.
No, she's going to do a quarter of a mile in a quarter of an hour for 28 days. Which is...
with sleep breaks, I don't know. But what's the total? She wants 1,500 miles, is that right?
So it was 2,700 quarter miles in 2,700 successive quarter hours, which was more than 600 miles.
Was this a common unit at the time? How many quarter miles and how many quarter hours will you walk?
No, I think it was just that they built this track and that seemed like a wild and woolly accomplishment. And it became like a major event, partly because there was no... You couldn't walk a mile and then take, as far as the contest was arranged, she had to walk every quarter hour, one quarter mile.
Oh, I see.
So she couldn't get some distance and then take 4 hour sleep. So this was part of what made it extremely difficult and why the Madison Square Garden people thought that she couldn't survive it.
She really has to hurry and run, finish her quarter mile so she can break to nap or eat and then do another one.
But as far as they erected a privacy tent there, because you can imagine you also have to go to the bathroom and other things.
I am imagining.
You have to, fluff up your hat or whatever it is.
Yeah, new ostrich feathers.
This is 1878. She never got more than 9 minutes of sleep at a time for 28 days. And what she did in part of her training to do this was that she trained herself to survive sleep deprivation.
Yeah, this doesn't seem healthy. You don't get lots of good deep sleep in that first 9 minutes after your head hits the pillow.
No, you don't. No, this is real catnap sport. But she accomplished it and she got... She had as many as 4,000 spectators a day. The venue had to eliminate some seats in order to accommodate her 187 or 189 foot track. But it made her a superstar.
Oh yeah.
There was some kind of sort of understanding at the time that people were now at this point Industrial Revolution style working these unusual shifts, 24-hour shifts or shifts, the night shift, et cetera. And because this was a 24-hour event...
You could drop by in the middle of the night.
You could drop by in the middle of the night and it would be going on and you could get a cheap ticket and go in and watch her walk. I think to me, at least, I mean, to us, it seems like not the greatest thing to watch, but... If you're betting on it, right. If you're like, she's never going to make it.
If you really don't believe it's humanly possible, it would be like seeing somebody pull an airplane with their teeth.
That's right.
This is how Vegas residency should work to me. Celine Dion should have to sing one song every quarter hour for a month and a half. And people could just drop by in the middle of the night and and wait for Celine to just wake up and blearily start belting.
Well, so by this point, Edward Payson Weston was now like a big walking star. So in 1879, there was going back to England for a second, an aristocrat by the name of Sir John Astley had started holding sort of racing contests that were pedestrianist, where within a certain amount of time, walkers were racing to see who could go the furthest. At the same time, without ever breaking the walk-run rule.
This does seem like it took a long time to get to the obvious discovery that this would be more exciting if you had multiple people doing it at once.
That's right.
Like, the ancient Greeks knew about racing, but it seems like it took pedestrianists a while to be like, what if it were a race instead of a month-long feat? I'm more into it already.
Well, and although it's still a very long event, you know, for going sort of multiple days, the Astley races were called Astley Belt races. You would win a commemorative belt that said you're the best racer. Oh. The Astley Belt race in Madison Square Garden was 6 days long. Who can walk the furthest in 6 days? And it was a massive success. 10,000 people a day watching the race walk.
You can see why basketball caught on. You know, like there's an excited audience that is desperate for any physical exertion, so much so that they will watch guys walk.
Yeah. Right. There was an African American walker by the name of Frank Hart, who was this was one of the first kind of interracial competitions where he was, you know, included in the, he was Bostonian. He was included in the race as a full fledged American.
Yeah. And I'm sure that powered some of the betting,
right. Can a black guy even do this?
Yeah.
There was a lot of controversy, not just because it was considered maybe cruel, but also there was moral controversy because it was seen as a result of the betting, seen as a seedy activity.
Right. Plus they're doing it on the Sabbath.
That's exactly right.
Oh, wait, really?
Walking on Sunday, in this kind of comic. In this guy, you know, that was the song that kept Till Tuesday's big hit.
Voices Carry.
It kept it out of the number one spot.
Oh, is that right? Amy Mann still has a grudge against Walking on Sunshine.
And she's really still mad about Walking on Sunshine. And so anytime I hear Walking on Sunshine, I'll text Amy and say, man, I heard Walking on Sunshine. What a great tune.
Do you think she's really ever met Katrina anywhere and like just...
The last I talked to her about it, she had not. Mm. But it's like the one. Can you imagine being kept out of the number one slot? And I mean, and I think "Walking on Sunshine" is a killer hit.
Yeah,
but
offense to Voices Carry.
Sorry, buddy,
with its traumatizing music video.
But there you were, like poised to have a number one record, a thing that no one can take away from you except Katrina of Katrina and the Waves. But yeah, Walking on Sunday. And especially if it was in conjunction with wagering, was the source of moral panic among some, you know, among the moral panickers. But the sport became, I think, then it was, you know, 1879 maybe was its global peak, where there really wasn't a bigger sport. There wasn't a bigger professional sport. Wow. Or sport of any kind.
This has really been memory hold, right? We don't really think about the early days of sport and how walking was king.
Well, and I think partly it's because what it became. In 1880, there had long been races where men raced against a horse.
Yes.
And horses really beat men at the racing game.
Over a sufficiently long distance?
Well, no. Over a distance that seemed sufficiently long up to a point, because nobody was racing a horse more than 5 miles. But in 1880, they staged a race, 15 men versus 5 horses, over 5 days. And the horses got way out in front, and for 3 days were handily beating the men. But gradually the horses were like, hey, no.
This is too long.
This sucks. And they started to just refuse to go. And the men just kept on keeping on, as men do.
It's kind of our thing.
And by the end of 5 days, a man named Michael Byrne beat the next, you know, beat the top running horse 578 miles to 563 miles.
So that is the distance where it's close.
Yeah, right. At some point, you know, he passed the horse, and people were like, oh, you know, huge cheer went up.
Yeah, it's like walking on the moon in 1879. We did it. We beat the horse.
We beat the horse, finally. And it, and this was the beginning of the whole thinking that human beings had evolved the way we did, with long legs, and because it coincided with all the conversation around evolution and
anthropology
and that was happening at that time.
Like, this is how you hunt.
This is why we don't have fur, and this is why we have long legs. We were built to run and run and run, or, you know, walk and walk and walk. And that was kind of part of the logic that I was exploring when I did the long walk.
You had heard that horses couldn't do it?
I was like, I'm going to beat the horse.
Did someone release a horse just ahead of you?
I'm going to. You know what?
The horse also has to walk. It's the hoof-to-toe rule.
The horse and I walked the whole way until it died. No, it was the idea, some weird nascent anthropological idea that going on a long walk was something fundamentally human, something basically human that was going to activate something in my body that would take me out of the poison of modernity and capitalist striving and consumerism and make me into some kind of higher order creature.
You're a romantic too. You're just like Goethe, only Goethe
longer.
Goethe of the 90s.
You know, I actually walked Goethe's
dog,
Rennsteig Trail in Thuringia. I walked that was not lost on me. I was like, you know what, Goethe? Here I come.
I can help out.
Walk, 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 walk. Now what do you got to say from beyond the grave?
That one pair of footsteps, that's where Goethe was carrying you.
It turned out that I got to the end and just came back and immediately started buying roast beef sandwiches again and just fell right back into my old habits. But
it did not turn you into the Sturm und Drang did not.
No. I picked up the electric guitar and I was like, well, you know, electricity does have its
I mean, the electric advantages. Guitar is kind of the modern version of a young romantic, right? Instead of walking in the mountains, you're noodling in your bedroom.
Thank you so much for noticing that. In 1881, so just immediately after Man Beats Horse, the sport started to precipitously decline. And it was partly because of the rise of other sports.
Literally anything's better than this.
Competitive pedestrianism paved the way for like other kinds of races and competitions, that a lot of them were set in these bucolic environments, outdoor track and field. But also right about then the bicycle was invented, which meant that you could have velodromic competitions that were indoors that were faster and had more danger and gave everybody the opportunity to do the same kind of betting.
I mean, in America, team sports start to pick up here too. Like baseball, like in the late 19th century, doesn't take long to just dominate the national conversation.
And baseball in 1881
was
happening. And all the sports that we detailed before, football, rugby, tennis, they were all now.
They're all coming.
Really big part of. And so you could watch a tennis game in a lot shorter amount of time than like 5 days. Tennis games. I mean, some cricket matches, as we've discussed, do last 5 days.
Yes.
And you can come and go at all hours because they play 24 hours a day.
But you do get the sense that any second you might see the absolute test of human ability, whereas in walking, really, that's only happening once extremely slowly, you know? Like, it's not like anything could happen here.
But gradually, the speed walking became maybe the distillation of the whole enterprise.
It's still a thing, right? Speed walking?
Well, so speed walking was at the heart of the foundation of the new Olympic movement.
Oh, yeah. It's only 10 years later. Right?
Yeah. And so Olympic speed walking, I mean, it was in 1880, there was in the UK the Amateur Athletics Association was formed, and this was kind of the germination of what became the International Olympic Movement, and the International Olympic Committee started in 1893, and race walking was included in the first Olympics, Well, I'm sorry. The first Olympics outside of Europe were in 1904 in St. Louis, Missouri, which in 1904 was a big, that was a big town.
I think they were having some kind of World's Fair. I think it it coincided with an expo of some kind.
And speed walking was included, the 880-yard walk. So a lot faster, a lot, you're in and out.
It's shorter. It's not a...
It was part of the overall track and field event. So it wasn't, I mean, since 1908, it's been an official Olympic event and still is part of the Summer Olympics.
Wait, they still do speed walking? It's just never on TV?
They do. It's just not on TV. This is something that when I learned it, I also said, wait a minute.
That can't be right.
I remember seeing speed walking, but it isn't. It can't seriously still be part of the Olympic Games, but it is.
Does that mean race walking? Like, could you put in a great sprinter? Or would they be really good at race walking? Like, what are the skills?
Well, the skills are don't lift your heel before the toe of the next foot has touched the ground.
So it's all just a timing?
Or rather, don't lift your toe until the heel has touched the ground.
There don't appear to be massive world powers at this. Like in the last three Olympics, the medalists have been from China, Italy, Japan, Ecuador, Brazil, Spain, and Australia, from just all over the place.
So somehow the Ethiopians
Guatemala recently won a silver in this event.
Well, that's the thing. You don't have to walk all over Guatemala. You only have to walk 1,000 yards.
Did I tell you about the time I walked across Guatemala?
It is one of the things that made that mid-19th century race walking... Well, that actually made stars out of some of these characters is that they had their own particular gaits. Walked with a swerve or a swivel or
so it was like seeing a novel baseball swing or something.
And kids would emulate their favorite walkers by doing the, you know, on the playground or wherever, doing the Willy Weasel or whatever, and everybody would recognize the gait and go, "Oh, you're doing Willy Weasel."
A sport without technique invents technique.
And so what makes a great speedwalker is that strange undulation of the hips, and you know, there's such a distinctive look.
There's a way to walk that's not the way you or I would walk or run that wins a race walking event, huh?
And I wonder if in the near future, some crazy kid from Guatemala will show up at the Olympics with a new race walking technique that blows away 80 years of, or 100 years plus of like standardized Willy Weasel, and all of a sudden it'll be back on the, you know, back in the headlines. Because, you know, marathoning was included in the early Olympics and was only a thing that happened in the Olympics throughout the 20th century until the 70s when hippies started making tennis shoes out of old tires.
That's when city marathons become a big thing.
And it was this kind of fitness, the beginning of this fitness culture, and people started doing marathons and that became a spectator sport. Again, unlikely spectator sport, but it was only since the 80s that like marathoning became a thing that it seemed like anybody in shape might try.
Maybe race walking will come back. So one thing I just noticed in the only extant distances, like the 20K is pretty much all that's left for Olympic race walking. And an American has never medaled, man or woman. So there's a chance for someone to become America's greatest race walker in centuries. All you have to do is win an Olympic medal. All you have to do is beat Guatemala.
One of our listeners in Brooklyn
just
put his knitting down, curled the ends of his waxed mustache, stood up and said,
"That's me. Hit the track." And that concludes pedestrianism, entry 913.PS1833, certificate number 21218, in the omnibus. Social media not in a great state, as we record these words. But we once were at Omnibus Project on various things.
What a stinker it is.
I'm now at Who Is Ken Jennings on Instagram, although my heart's maybe not really in it yet.
Have you posted anything?
Yeah.
Are you following me is the big question.
Oh, I don't know.
What do you mean you don't know?
I follow you with my surveillance burner account. The official Jeopardy one, I might just follow Jeopardy. I don't know.
Come on, bro.
Jeopardy pays the bills. Jeopardy keeps the lights on around here.
Well, actually, these lights right here are kept on by me.
Probably not so much, yeah.
There are a lot of lights in this room, aren't there?
They are, and they need fixtures, right?
Yeah, there's right now a lot of lights just sort of dangling.
You have a lot of holes in the ceiling, and they are glowing. I do. Does that make them lights?
I think a glowing hole in a ceiling qualifies as a light, yeah.
But there's probably some kind of panel you could put over that.
There, and you'll also notice there are a lot of different kinds of light fixture down here.
You got squares, you got circles. You had a handyman living here before you moved in, and he liked all the shapes.
He was an electrical engineer at Boeing, and he liked all the shapes. Yeah.
It really shows.
Most of these light fixtures actually came from Boeing surplus. So they originally were, I don't know, the B-17 was made underneath all these lights.
Yeah, I tried to turn on one of your lights and I accidentally hit my flight attendant call button.
That's right.
It was very annoying. So, track down. What are you on Instagram? At John Roderick?
Yeah. I was an early adopter of all of the mid-2000s social media sites. So I'm at John Roderick at everything. I never had to be at John Roderick 69.
The Jeopardy folks tried to get me at Ken Jennings at Instagram and were unable to wrestle it away from whatever 15-year defunct user.
Exactly.
Still has it.
Some guy that had a plumbing supply company.
Never posted.
It's so probably your dad, actually.
Wow.
Kenneth Jennings.
What a twist. He's just been keeping all the good usernames from me for years. So find at John Roderick, at Who Is Ken Jennings on Instagram. And I guess we're both on Blue Sky still.
Yeah.
For some reason.
I'm on Mastodon, all these things.
I guess we should start an at Omnibus Project on some of these. But I'm very sleepy right now. The problem.
Our good friend at Omnibus Out of Context, a person neither of us have met or really communicated with very much, posted a thing the other day. What's the one that's connected to Instagram? Threads.
That's Threads.
He posted a thing on Threads that after Facebook said we're no longer going to fact check, he said, I'm out of here as a protest.
Yeah, they did that right after I started my Instagram too. Thanks. Thanks, Zuckerberg. Appreciate you.
So, I think a lot of people protested Threads and went, I think, over to Blue Sky, but I don't know. I really have found that the less I'm online, the better.
Exactly. So follow our lead. Do not get online.
But if you do,
at Omnibus Project, maybe. You can write us. That's always better. That's safe.
Right? I think so.
Write to P.O. Box 55744, Shoreline, Washington 98155. What have we here? Lauren and Roman of Missouri have invited me to their wedding. That's nice.
Hey, unfortunately, but not me, eh?
Unfortunately, it was last month. Maybe I get a plus one. And if I had a time machine and a plus one, it's at a funeral home. Is that normal? Are they goths?
Does sound pretty goth.
Is this just what they do in Missouri? Like that's the town meeting place for event spaces?
Here, now, I hate to interrupt the end of our show because I know you like to end shows.
Yeah, let's get out of here.
That's not my way.
No.
But right now, I'm bidding on a 1967,
oh, yeah,
Cadillac DeVille convertible, and the bidding is up to what seems to me to be a very affordable, not because I have a lot of money, but because the car is worth more than this, an affordable $12,000.
How much time to go in the auction?
And the top bidder is someone named Ben _ Man.
Why are you naming your...
Ben Man.
Why are you naming your... enemies.
I'm shame naming them.
People are going to stalk Ben _ Man now.
And here are some of the bidders. M. Mark, Stumptown Traveler, Richard YK.
Yeah, this is good content.
Kim Lama. Anyway, so they're all in a bidding war for this thing. It's now $12,000. There's 8 minutes and 34 seconds left. do I put in another bid? I'll almost certainly be outbid, but do I try and stay in the game here?
I don't think this will make, this is like social media. You think it makes you happy. But the Cadillac DeVille was the social media of its day.
What if I had a Cadillac DeVille? Would you think I was cooler or would you think I was lame? If I was rolling around Seattle in a 67 DeVille, it's teal green with a white interior.
It's a great car, don't get me wrong.
But does it fit my current lifestyle?
Does it fit anybody's lifestyle in 2025?
I feel like if I lived in Arizona and I moved to Babylona, maybe it's just not very good on Capitol Hill.
It's not good for Seattle parking spaces and lanes. I'm just going to keep opening the mail.
Okay, you keep doing
that. You have 8 minutes to solve your problem. I'm still getting Christmas cards. Kevin from London. Is that right? That's what it says on the envelope, I think. He's an American, but he works for the UK Postal Service.
Huh. And isn't that a violation? Shouldn't he lose his citizenship? He's working for a foreign government.
That's a foreign entity, right? Yeah. He knows postal secrets. I hope he's not selling them our postal secrets.
Listen, it's $12,500. I was just about to bid $12,400, and somebody came in underneath me, so I'm going to screw those people.
You told me what your cap is. Do you want to tell Omnibus listeners how high you would go?
What did I say?
You said 18K.
$18,000 is what I think it should sell for.
Oh, but that's not your personal limit?
I don't have $18,000. I don't have $12,000. What am I talking
this
about?
This just got easier. I don't think you should bid then.
I don't have money that I can just throw away on something dumb like this, but I'm super dumb.
The thing you have to remember, I'm quite dumb.
I'm like so dumb, and this is the kind of bipolar decision I make sometimes when my medication isn't
working. Let me take your phone. So I can be your medication. If you just give me your phone for the next 5 minutes and 38 seconds.
Wow, what a great love song title. I can be your medication.
If you're making bad decisions,
I'm writing that down.
I can be the bed restraints that keep you from
that kind of has a sympathetic rhyme. If you are making bad decisions, I can be your medication. Ken, I'm writing that down.
This guy's name is the postal trader here is named Kevin, but it appears his letter is signed with something that doesn't look like Kevin at all. It looks like a 9 and then a squiggle.
How does a 9 look like a K?
Oh no, I see it. I see it. The 9 and the part of the squiggle is the K, and then it goes, maybe it's Kev? There's a dot. Hard to say what's going on with Kevin's signature, but he's because of his transatlantic postal experience, he was very interested in our zip code experiments, whether 98155 works better than 33344.
How does that work in the UK?
They have their postal codes, but they're like... this is London SWS9HB, it appears.
SWS9HB.
So they've got it starts with Southwest and stuff like that, right? Isn't that how all the postal codes begin?
Holy cow.
What did it go up to?
Camfin just bid, so it went boom, boom, boom. There was 12,500. The next minute, Never Enough Cars bid 13,000. Then Camfin went over them at 14,000. Never Enough Cars came in at 15. Camfin went to 16. Never Enough Cars is at 17. I knew that this was going to be a price tag.
Well, I mean, their username really kind of gives away.
Yeah, these two guys are going for it.
This guy thinks there's never enough cars.
Never enough cars.
And that's why he'll pay any price.
Why was I even in this game? You know what?
It's just a recipe for sadness.
I'm just like Mr. Guy that is, everybody's richer than me.
You should be happy that you got out.
I am.
This is like,
I am.
Yeah, this is like, giving up a smoking habit. You just earned, basically you just earned $18,000.
Yeah,
Now what are you going to do with it?
Put it into some kind of like low yield account.
That's
in
right.
The hopes that I don't have to work when I'm 90.
You're going to put it in index funds and not buy anything stupid.
Well, Ken, in this case, you were my medication.
I'm glad it helped. Kevin says the reason why he wrote to us is because they get a bunch of free stamps every year.
Oh, and so he was like, what do I do with all these stamps?
I'll even write to these guys.
I keep hearing about this.
Thank you, Kevin. I also found a bunch of these old... Did we show this eclipse postcard from Rebecca?
That's really pretty beautiful.
She says she was in Waco and went to the Dr. Pepper Museum.
Hey!
Where she bought the eclipse of...
The famous Dr. Pepper eclipse.
The famous Dr. Pepper eclipse, where a can of Dr. Pepper went in front of the sun.
That seems like a cool goth t-shirt.
Indigenous populations were terrified at the giant can of Dr. Pepper.
Doesn't that seem like a thing that's kind of like the New Order t-shirt? It should just be...
Yeah, exactly. Everyone has an eclipse moving over your nipples. Thank you, Rebecca, as well as Kevin, although less thanks to you because, you know, you didn't have to buy the stamps. Sorry we missed your wedding, Lauren and Roman. Please send us things. If you don't want to, you can always... did I read the address? I think I did. If you don't want to send us physical items, or if your employer does not give you free stamps, you can just send us communications at theomnibusproject@gmail.com. You could support the show in a variety of ways. Leave us a nice review. Commune with your fellow futurelings online. But the thing that really moves the needle and will allow John to buy...
No, allow me to
large finned
not
cars.
Have to work when I'm 80. That's really what the money is.
Has the auction ended, by the way? Did Cam Finn get it or never enough cars?
Well, so here's the drama.
Uh-oh.
Cam Finn wrote, after the 17,000 bid placed by Never Enough Cars, Cam Finn wrote, Cam Finn has too many cars.
You can write messages to explain your lack.
Yeah.
Because in an auction, you can't do that. You can put down your paddle, but you can't be like, I lost interest, just ran out of money.
This is full of people saying things like, that's not the stock exhaust. But Canfin said, too many cars as one word, to imitate Never Enough Cars as a handle.
I see. So it looks like Never Enough Cars is going to run away with this thing?
And then Canfin says, this is one of the best 67-68 caddies ever listed on Bring a Trailer. And the bidding now... There's 1:48, and it's under the 18,000 that I thought it would go for. Should I get in?
Ken? No.
17,000.
Let's time this so the episode ends exactly when the auction ends. So we have like, what, 1:20?
1:37.
Go. So support John's, not his habit, but his retirement, by supporting Omnibus. Patreon.com/Omnibus Project makes you a supporter of the show. You get that good feeling, but not just that good feeling. You also get a variety of... We back a truck up to your door with presents and prizes, basically.
We
do. I hope you enjoy that.
I was doing a podcast with Nick Harcourt the other day, who was the DJ on the Los Angeles television or the Los Angeles radio program, Morning Becomes Eclectic, which was the sort of indie, the cool indie rock show in L.A., and he has a podcast now, and I was doing the podcast. And he, it turns out, is a reliable Omnibus listener.
Well, that's nice.
Big fan. And I did not think to ask him if he was subscribed to the Patreon.
Radio salaries not being what they were. This is going to end before the thing ends, because you haven't even done the Providence Allows yet, right?
Listen to this.
What's happening now?
It was 17,000, and then here are the bids, and this all happened within 1 minute. Steve 305 bid 17,250. Richard YK went to 18,000. Never Enough Cars went to 20. Richard YK is now the guy.
What about
21,000?
Is he Andrew YK's brother?
I'm not sure. Never Enough Cars is at 22,000.
It's Andrew WK.
If I rented out my bedroom upstairs, I wouldn't be in this anymore. $22,000. I think the thing's actually worth $30,000.
You've been priced out. Oh, you were convinced by the, this is one of the best caddies that's ever appeared on Bring a Trailer.
I don't think that's necessarily true, but no, it's too bad for me. Anyway.
Did it just end?
No, because here's the thing about Bring a Trailer.
Oh, there's overtime? There's penalty minutes?
If you bid after the 2 minute mark, it resets to 2 minutes.
Oh.
Basically keeping people from being snipers.
Yeah, that's smart, actually.
But it's very smart, except why does everybody wait until the last 2 minutes to bid? They know it's going to... There is no sniping, so...
So, yeah, so don't wait.
You should have just said however much, but don't wait. But now it's in the two-minute window, and people are just bing, 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 bing. 25,000, Never Enough Cars.
25.
He's up to 25. He's just like, screw you, Richard RK or YK.
He wants this.
Oh, man. I don't know. This show can't go on this whole time.
What if we also added 2 minutes to the show every time
one of us
said something in the outro? Oh, sorry, 2 more minutes. You just changed the subject in the outro. That's a 2-minute penalty.
Futurelings, from our vantage point in your distant past, we have no idea how long our civilization survived. We hope and pray that the catastrophe we fear may never come. But if the worst comes soon, this recording, like all our recordings, may have been our final word. But if Providence allows, Never Enough Cars is at 27,000. We hope to be back with you soon for another entry. Richard YK is at 28,000. And it reset to 2 minutes for another entry in the Omnibus.
Coda has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including the Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal, Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
While everyone's talking about AI replacing people, smart companies know the real opportunity is using AI to make their people better. Lattice is the HR platform where people and AI succeed together, helping every employee grow, every manager lead, and every company achieve greater success. Let's build a people-powered future. No regrets. Visit lattice.com/no regrets. That's LATTICE.com/no regrets.